Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Hargens.
Oh boy, thank you very much for downloading this particular podcast. If you're new here, welcome. There's seats in the back. Come and join. We're talking about independent music and the people who make up this awesome DIY independent music scene that we love, whether it's punk, hardcore, emo rap like we're going to be talking about today, anything that falls under this broad spectrum of people in small, sweaty rooms, doing things, not asking permission, all of that is what we do here. And this guest today is, I'm very excited to have him because he definitely, from a musical perspective, falls sort of outside the spectrum of what I typically cover. You know, whether it's obviously kind of treading into the punk and hardcore world, that's what I predominantly lean into. But I find people that make music outside of that and affect culture in a lot of different ways. And this person is the embodiment of that. His name is Joe Mulheron, and I'm totally butchering his last name, I'm guessing. But Joe Mulheron, I'll say it again, he plays under the moniker Nothing Nowhere. And for those of you who have been paying attention to the whole youth culture movement of emo rap, and I use that maybe in air quotes, there is a whole scene that exists where it is combining the, you know, the principles of kind of whatever, modern rap, whatever you want to call it, like, you know, sort of Drake-influenced, wearing your heart in your sleeve, talking about, you know, feelings as opposed to, you know, kind of what maybe like whatever 90s gangster rap would talk about. But then combining that with all of the DIY principles that, you know, maybe exist within, I mean, clearly within the punk hardcore scene, but I would also compare it to kind of like the early 2000s when, you know, there were so many independent hip hop artists coming up from, you know, Aesop Rock and Atmosphere and all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of combining that all into this interesting stew that is what Nothing Nowhere does. Because I mean, I'll be honest, like when this first kind of hit the scene, most people were just scratching their heads being like, what the heck is this? I don't even know where to put this. But Joe, you know, he did his thing and he worked really, really hard to not only hone his craft, but show that he is a legitimate artist. And the dude has deep connections within the context of punk and hardcore. Vegan, straight edge, a lot of interesting things going on. So I had to have him on the show, and that is why. Like for some of you that maybe just write this person off, just look a little bit below the surface. Like maybe musically you don't identify with what he does, but I think he is important nonetheless, and his experience it will probably surprise you that it's very similar to yours. So just put whatever preconceived notions you have aside. I just want to, you know, do that preamble. But you can always email the show 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. I love to hear from you. I love all of the feedback and guest ideas and all that sort of stuff. Really appreciate that. Been a little bad on getting back to email, but I'm trying to. I got some plane flights coming up, so I'll be able to dig into a little bit of that response time. And then please, if you haven't done so, go to Apple Podcasts, leave a review, stars, 5 stars, hopefully, if you find value in the show. But then, you know, write maybe a sentence or two on it, because that helps the algorithm of recommending this particular podcast to other people that should be listening to this podcast, because that's the only way that this gets out. And of course, you can tell a friend, like, you know, tag the guest on social media, all that stuff helps. So I would appreciate any light you can shine on this particular podcast. I do appreciate it. So yeah, let's talk to Joe. And I will, of course, at the end of the episode, tell you who comes up the following week, because we have great guests coming up. So here's my discussion with Joe, and I'll talk to you after. I assure you, this is not meant to be disrespectful in any way, but in first listening to you, it made me feel old. And, but at the same time, like, I also got it, because it was like, okay, like, I am of a certain age demographic where the style of music that, you know, you are participating in was, you know, like, literally not around 10 years ago. And so it's interesting. And I imagine it feels pretty satisfying for you to be able to, like, put yourself out there and probably initially have people be like, what the hell is this, dude? What are you doing? But then ultimately find your space. Like, and I realize that's maybe a big thing to lead off with, but like, do you feel, I guess, you know, like, that is reflective of your experience, or is it kind of, you know, another way that you're going?
Yeah. I mean, like, I just wanted to do stuff that no one else was really doing, or that had, like, almost a non-existent scene. I mean, when I started doing Nothing Nowhere stuff in, like, 2014, and I just wanted to create sounds that were just different. I just got tired of hearing bands that all sounded the same and just recycled stuff. And obviously now, like, I guess what I started doing is, it's, you know, everyone does it now, but it's just fun to, like, I don't know, I never really come across new genres. And, like, whenever I hear something that is different, or because everything's so oversaturated now with Spotify and playlisting and everything, it's just, like, sick to hear something different. So I love that. I love getting, like, a weird response from people, like, making weird music.
Right. And I know, and it is, I agree with you, because it, you know, even though, like I was saying, for my own personal experience, and I'm sure many other people's experiences, where it's like, initially it's kind of met with that sort of, you know, like, just really quizzical looks, like, in the sense of, you know, I mean, it's like any other band, you know, playing their first shows, where it's just like, what the hell is this band trying to do? But then once you show that you're serious about your art and your expression, then people, you know, and as long as it's authentic to you, eventually come around and understand. Whether or not they like it, they at least understand where you're coming from, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, if like, even if I don't expect everyone to like what I'm doing, but, you know, like, I'll hear something or I'll see some type of art that I'm like, well, you know, that's not my thing, but I respect it because they're serious about it and it's like their life, you know? And I guess, like, you know, our mutual friend Yvonne, who's my manager, she really put me through the ringer. My first tour ever was opening for Thrice, and Thrice fans were, you know, they're notoriously not, you know, I don't want to say they're closed-minded, but they definitely know what they like. And it was me, Thrice, and La Dispute. And I just remember, like, you know, going on stage, first tour ever, you know, 2,000 cap rooms, just shaking in my boots, trying to do something different. And I'd like to say that a lot of the shows, we went over some older folks by the end of the show, and, like, it really, like, gave me the confidence, like, okay, like, if I'm serious about it, they'll be down with it.
Right. Totally. And honestly, that, you know, like you said, being put through the ringer, like, that trial by fire to really, you know, put yourself in front of people that are obviously not going to be automatically
you know, on your side and just be like, oh, like impress me, you know, like every artist kind of goes through that in some capacity. But for you to be able to do that earlier on, to be like, am I really serious about this? Like, does this feel right to me personally? Not so much how the crowd is reacting, but does this feel right to me?
Yeah. And that was the thing. Like, it felt right to me. It's like all I wanted to do. And like, I just wanted to create authentically and make sounds that I thought were rad. And like, I was kind of like blissfully naive, and I'm glad that I was, you know, and I just kind of did my thing. And then like, here I am now, just still doing my thing, I guess.
Right. No, and it's cool. And I think that's what really, because of, you know, your longevity, even though, you know, like you said, 2014 to, you know, 2021, like, you know, that's less than 10 years, but at the same time that, you know, probably it feels like dog years in certain respects, where you're like, oh, wow, I've been doing this for almost 10 years. This is wild.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, it's just insane to see how the landscape changes and like learning the music industry and like just, you know, going through my 20s, like in fully embedded in the music industry and seeing how it changes, seeing how it chews up musicians, spits them out, seeing, you know, labels pick up the next big wave of things and genres changing. And I think more than ever, it just like fueled me to just be like, all right, just keep continuing like what you're doing and follow your intuition, really. Cause the trends change and the numbers change, but it's like, you know, good music is good music, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That hopefully, what do they say? The content is king.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, putting the focus on you squarely, I'll pull apart some things that, you know, about your musical progression over this chat. But, you know, I know you were born and raised in the Massachusetts area. What city did you come up in particular?
So I grew up in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Okay. There's nothing cool about Foxborough. I mean, it was a great place to grow up. Made a lot of really great lifelong friends, but it was really just kind of like culturally devoid and just suburbs. And I guess the New England Patriots Stadium was there, and that was kind of their claim to fame.
Right. Yeah, the reason I ask is because, you know, especially like the Boston, you know, the greater Boston area, like each one of those cities had its own really interesting specific scene. Like, I'll never forget once I first started to show up to like the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival in Worcester. It was like, that was so different than what was happening, you know, in Boston or, you know, any of the other surrounding suburbs. And so it just was really interesting to see all these cities had their own thing going on.
Yeah. Mass is so weird. Like, yeah, like Worcester is nothing like Boston. Boston is nothing like Brockton. You know, like it's just everyone's a townie pretty much. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Like, you know, you watch The Departed or like anything with like, you know, you watch Good Will Hunting. He never wants to leave the city. It's like, I know a lot of kids like that, but it's cool because like, I don't know. I guess it's cool to have pride in where you're from. And like, I guess Boston does that really well.
Yeah, I think you hit that nail on the head. You're very right. What was your family structure like growing up? You know, like mom and dad in the house, brothers and sisters?
Yeah, just, you know, your standard, you know, American one sister, mom, dad, still together. We had a yellow lab, you know, grew up in a decent, you know, house. I mean, it was pretty standard, par for the course type thing. And, you know, my parents, my dad's an accountant, my mom's a nurse. And I was just doing my thing, like not a great student, skateboarding, playing music, playing guitar, and just kind of going through the motions, I guess.
Right. As most kids do in the, you know, whatever, middle-class suburban upbringing where you're just trying to find, I guess, your space or your tribe and the people where you're like, oh, like you get me and I get you.
Yeah, exactly. And that was huge, like for me, because like in elementary school and like early middle schools, like I didn't really have those connections. And it wasn't until, you know, I found people who listened to the same music as me and like got into emo and post-hardcore and hardcore, where I was like, oh, I found some like this makes sense. Like, I want this to be my life. And I'm like, you know, like late 20s now. And it's like, it is definitely my life.
Right. No, that's cool. And were you, you said older sister or younger sister?
Older sister. Yeah. She's like 2.5 years older than me. And yeah, we're still close. She lives in Australia now. Shout out to Rory. And she, yeah, she was always kind of in the same, into the same stuff as I am. And she was like the party animal kid and I was like the angel boy. It, like, she would come home, like the cops would deliver her home from like parties all the time. And she just, I'd open the door and she'd be crying with a police officer. I'd just be like, all right, mom, Rory's home. Like, but, you know, she's older now and like she's got everything figured out. But yeah,
yeah.
She's rad.
That's amazing. So you were not only, you know, the baby of the group, where usually the, you know, baby of the siblings is usually the one that gets like doted on because it's like, oh, you know, little Joey. But on top of that, you also had the sister that was blazing the trail and, you know, causing havoc, where it's like, oh, Joe's an angel.
Yeah, the bar was set so low, you know.
and you could thank your sister for that. That's great.
Yeah, always.
That's amazing. And so I'm going to guess that by, you know, just kind of publicly judging you, like you, and kind of like you mentioned in, you know, this chat and previous interviews that, you know, you were just kind of looking for, you know, your identity, but I'm guessing that you were kind of a, I guess, a quiet kid. Were you like into sports? You know, where did you sort of start trying to find yourself?
I'd say like, you know, like fourth grade, I started listening to Linkin Park and Limp Bizkit and like all this new metal stuff and Alien Ant Farm, and got into like bands like that. And it wasn't until, and I guess there was like a skate park that was built behind my elementary school, and I just would kind of go there and, you know, push around. And then it just kind of blossomed as I went into middle school and started listening to like second or third wave emo stuff, you know, Senses Fail, Taking Back Sunday, Thursday. And really, really kind of found out like, oh, this is what I like. You know, I didn't really know what I was about. I was just like an anxious kid, like having panic attacks and just not really sure what life was about until I found like music and like art.
Right. No, that's cool. I mean, usually that's what music is there for, especially when you're in the formative years and you can, you know, not only identify what the lyrics are talking about, but then start to feel like you're part of a larger community.
Yeah. Just be like a bummed out little kid. Like, no one understands me, you know, that was great.
Of course. Yeah. Angsty, just like, and honestly, it's funny because that is such a timeless image where it's like, you can close your eyes and imagine, you know, a kid of the 60s, you know, feeling, you know, despondent about, you know, whatever was happening in the, you know, civil rights era or anything else. And it's like that, you can imagine that, like, it's timeless and it's so cool because of that.
Yeah. Growing up's tough. I like, yeah. I went skateboarding today and passed the playground and saw these little kids out, and I was like, I don't envy that, because growing up was a bummer, but I don't know, maybe it wasn't for everyone, but it was for me.
Well, I agree with you. There are challenges no matter which way you go. You know, even if you're a popular kid, it's that notion of how that popularity, like, you know, how do I make that last, or like, or whatever. Like, there's so many landmines you have to navigate. And, you know, usually no one besides, you know, maybe a sibling, maybe your parents will be able to help you through it. But a lot of it is just all trial and error.
Yeah. I mean, like, I had a while where I was really nostalgic and like, didn't want to grow up or whatever, but, you know, now being an adult, like, I feel like I'd rather pay bills, like, you know, no one likes paying bills, but I think I'd rather do that than have to like walk through a high school cafeteria and like find a table, you know what I mean? It's like scarier.
Right. Yeah. You're like, paying power bills suck or whatever, but it, you know, I'll pay the $50 just so I don't have to walk through that cafeteria again.
I know, just nightmares. I still have dreams about being in high school, and I'm like 28, and they're like, why are you here? And I'm like, I don't know, I'm 28. And they're like, well, you got to do it again. You got 4 more years. I'm like, oh, dang. That's nightmare.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, I'm sure you've met and have, you know, people that have come through your life where it's, they look back on their, you know, high school experience and those are like the best times of their life. And it's just like, wow, okay, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of a trip for sure. I mean, yeah, I don't think it really was for me.
Yeah, sure, I get that. And so I'm guessing too that, you know, were you, like you said, as you started to, you know, in fourth grade, get exposed to, you know, more aggressive music, I'm going to guess that your household wasn't necessarily, you know, a musical household where you had, you know, instruments and stuff lying around and your parents were maybe like spinning records and stuff like that.
No, not really. I mean, my dad, you know, grew up like he loves The Clash and, you know, Iggy and the Stooges and like weird obscure stuff like Ian Dury and the Blockheads and like just weird, like he has really great music taste and he would definitely have records around, and my mom used to be a disco dance teacher, so she was on the other spectrum, but no one in my family like really played music. I guess I had like a second cousin who gave me an acoustic guitar when I was probably 11, and then from there it was like, okay, it's a wrap, this thing is sick.
That's awesome. I love that, where it's like, you know, the clouds parted and this, you know, like secondhand guitar just opened up your world.
Yeah, it was like the coolest thing ever, because I was probably watching, you know, like Sum 41 videos or whatever I was doing at the time, and I was like, I want to do that. And then I got a guitar and I was like, yep, I'm gonna do that someday.
Right. And with skateboarding, that was, I know, a huge touch point for you as well. Did you make that immediate connection of, you know, skateboarding and music being so intertwined together, or did you like, did one kind of lead the other?
I think I got into them at the same time. Honestly, like it was like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater came out. Everyone was bugging out about the soundtrack, and there was like Rage Against the Machine and like Del the Funky Homo Sapien and all this crazy music. And then I got a skateboard for Christmas from my grandma. And yeah, it just felt like it was always the, you know, one and the same. Like it was, the culture was so intertwined with like skate videos and music and stuff. And I just got way better at one of those things than the other.
Right. You're like, skateboarding. Yeah. You push around, like you said.
Yeah. I'll push around.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and especially too with the, I think, and this probably applies to music as well, when you watch people doing it, whether it's, you know, skate videos or obviously like music videos and interact with that, you start to see the difficulty levels being so transparently different, where it's like, dude, to do an 8-stair versus playing a power chord, like one is so much easier than the other, you know?
Yeah. And like, yeah, I don't have to like break myself off doing, you know, learning the pentatonic scale on a guitar, you know? It's yeah. Just like a whole different thing. When I was younger, like I remember like tossing myself downstairs and stuff, but now I'm just like, I don't want to go to the hospital.
That is a very simple but true statement. I think most people want to protect themselves like that.
You know what I'm going to talk about, right? No, maybe you don't, but you should think about band merch. And the place that should come to the top of your mind when you think about band merch is rockabilia.com. Use this code 100words that gets you 10% off your entire order. And that will let them know that this particular show sent you. But band merch is incredibly vital to all bands. I don't think I can make that clear enough, but when you buy from legitimate sources, aka rockabilia.com, the bands get paid because this is all officially licensed stuff. This isn't some, you know, bootleg scenario. This isn't some, you know, buying a horrible ripoff on Amazon. This is the real deal. They ship it to you fast, friendly. They have so much stuff. Like, I actually showed a friend this website. Like, he doesn't have any real context for music as far as the independent variety, but he just dove onto that website and was like, dude, they have everything. And I'm like, I know, right? So you will have so much fun going onto that website and finding all of the merch that you can outfit yourself, your family, your friends, and then you get 10% off. Again, 100 words, that's 100 words, 10% off Rockabilia, the best place to buy band merch on the internet. Trust me, go have fun and buy band merch.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
And so once you started to, you know, dive more deeply into, like you said, you know, this sort of whatever second, third wave, you know, emo, hardcore, punk and all that sort of stuff, how were your parents reacting to, you know, most likely stuff that they had no context for? And what is the loud screaming stuff coming out of, you know, Joe's room? Like, how are they reacting to that? Or did they just kind of let you be?
They're super supportive. And just, you know, I just tortured my mom with Senses Fail and Silverstein CDs on the way to the skate park every day. And, but she would always let me play them. And my dad would just be like, these band names are awful. But like, you know, they would always kind of give me shit, but they were always supportive of what I wanted to do. And when I wanted to start doing guitar lessons, my mom would drive me there. And then I had a little, you know, band with my friends, and my mom would drive us to our little community center gigs and stuff like that. So I was like super fortunate to have parents that, you know, kind of like fostered my creativity like that.
Yeah, that's really cool. Especially like I was, you know, joking about that most parents don't have a context for this stuff that they don't identify with. And I could just imagine you with your dad. It's like, what is the name of this band? And you're like, yeah, you know, like Silverstein or the Used, obviously. And he's just like, what is this? I don't understand it at all. But then still being like, yeah, you can leave it in the, you know, the Discman or whatever.
Yeah. I think they saw that I was so passionate about it and I was happy when I was listening to this stuff, and it just, you know, I was like being myself. And I think that whether or not they understood it didn't matter. And they just were like, hey, this makes Joe like stoked, so we're going to support it. And like, if I ever have kids, like I hope I could do the same thing.
Sure. You're right. And you're like, what are they going to bring home that is going to be really foreign and weird to me? And I'm going to be like, well,
crazy, some hyper pop, like jazz or something.
Yeah, you're like, well, I don't understand this at all, but go for it, little son or daughter.
Straight up.
Yeah. I know that we were talking about this off you know, off mic, so to speak, but you know, you're straight edge, and do you actually like claim that label, or is that just something like you're, you know, define yourself as sober or whatever?
I think when I was younger, I mean I'm still sober, like I've never drank or done anything, but when I was younger, I was more involved in sort of like hardcore music. And, you know, I even have like a tattoo, like a XXX tattoo on my leg and all that. But like, I think nowadays I just like, it's become so second nature to me that I'm just like, yeah, like people see me not drinking or something, and I'm just like, oh, I just like, don't do that stuff. And they're like, why? And I'm like, I don't know, I just don't. It's right. Always funny, and like it's just my life. I don't know. I don't know anything different now.
Yeah, sure. Well, and especially too, when you're interacting with, you know, what I like to call civilians, most of the time people are just like, you don't have the time to walk them through what straight edge is. Like, it's just easier to be I don't drink.
I'm gonna be like, there's this band, Minor Threat, and like, right. You know, like a lot of like, yeah, I don't know.
Right. They used to put X's in the back of their hands because, you know, they were underage. And it's just like, wait, what are you talking about, Joe? Stop it.
Yeah.
So I guess how did, you know, straight edge come into your life? Because I find it interesting because, you know, generationally speaking, there are different touch points for people, whether it's like, you know, using a random example, but, you know, I saw Davey Havoc talking about straight edge. And so that was like my initial thrust. So where did it come to, you know, your understanding?
I'd say musically, it was probably Have Heart, you know, growing up in the Boston area, you know, Straight Edge was huge and Have Heart was huge. And Pat, like, always had a positive message, and learning about PMA and, like, you know, living like authentically and like just being positive, like, really got me stoked. And I kind of had people around me growing up, and I saw some stuff growing up that was, I guess, challenging. And I saw from a young age kind of what drugs and alcohol could do to people. Not that it would happen to me. It was just kind of like one of those things where I was like, all right, like, what else does life have to offer? So it just worked for me. And I, like, got stoked that there was a subculture of other kids who were doing the same thing, and I didn't have to feel like an idiot or whatever.
Right. Yeah, there was an actual, not only community, but term for this, and you were able to plug into it and feel like you were a part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, even in high school, like, if you don't drink, like, or you don't go to parties or whatever, like, you just feel so disconnected from everything. And it was just like a sigh of relief for sure. I mean, like, now, like, I have, like, all my friends drink or whatever, and it's like, you know, you get older and you're just like, yeah, that's a part of life. It's just something I don't really do.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And you don't need to be, you know, judgmental or wanting to beat them up because they drink.
That was insane. Like, that era of, like, straight edge, like, you know, like, Boston Beatdown and stuff like that. That was truly insane to the point where it was like, I don't even know if I want to go to shows because it's just like wanting to fight people because they drink or smoke is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
I agree wholeheartedly. And it was such a weird, I guess, mixing pot of all of these different elements, like, that, you know, sort of pseudo jock mentality mixed with that notion of, you know, I mean, what you were talking about earlier, that whole townie mentality where it's just like, oh, you're from, you know, you're Brockton, I'm going to punch you. It's like, yeah, it was such a, like, it really could have only happened in Boston from that perspective.
Yeah, straight up. Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. Yeah. Just like the gym shorts and the Air Maxes and the puffy jackets, and what a time.
I know. That's true. Yeah, very true. Very true. So what were kind of your earliest shows that you went to, and what, I guess, sort of spoke to you as you started to experience more of that, you know, kind of DIY scene, as it were? I mean, even if it was, you know, going to shows at the House of Blues in Boston or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, probably, like, I just have memories of seeing hardcore bands play at my local skate park. You know, there was, like, bands like 40 SLS and Energy and just random smaller, very small bands. And I just thought it was rad. And it was so cool. And they would always get shut down because there'd be swears, and the lady who owned the skate park would come and yell at everyone. And I was like, this is sick. So I got into that, and then, you know, started going to, like, VFW shows and just, you know, standing in a room that smells like mothballs with, you know, fluorescent lights. And I was like, this is awesome. Which, like, objectively, it's not. It's terrible. But to me and to, like, kids, like, hearing that music, no matter where you are, is, like, the coolest thing ever. So I got into that. I was never, like, a huge show kid, though. Like, I didn't go to a ton of shows because I was just too anxious. Like, I couldn't be around that many people, but I got into it. Like, I collected all the CDs and, like, just was all about it.
Right. You were as involved as your comfort level allowed it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And like you said, once music became such a part of your life, you already had the guitar and, you know, you were attending shows and stuff like that. And you said that school was basically just like you were on sort of a coasting pattern. Did you have any sense of like what a quote unquote life path would look like? Were you, you know, like, did your dad be like, all right, Joe, you're going to be an accountant or whatever?
I don't know. I think in the back of my head, I was always like, yep, I just want to make music. I just want to make music. Like, that's what I want to do. I had this voice in my head that was like, oh, it's not going to work out. Like, you're not going to make money making music. It's like winning the lottery. And, I decided that in my head, for some reason, that going into the film industry was more realistic than music, which is like, makes zero sense. So I went to film school, and because I was totally into making films and doing all that, and I still am. I'm still into cinematography, but I remember doing that, but still I had that voice in the back of my head, and I was still making music, and I was like, yeah, I know what I should be doing, what I want to be doing. And eventually, I mean, I'm fast forwarding a lot, but you know, after film school and some internships, I quit my job and saved up $3,000 and just sent it with nothing, nowhere. And finally something stuck after years and years of, you know, suburban failed bands and solo projects and whatever.
Yeah. Well, you gotta, I mean, in my opinion, you definitely have to have those experiences because, you know, whatever quote unquote failures you encounter there will lead you to be like, okay, so I don't need to do that exact thing that I did the previous band or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like failing upwards, as they say. Like, you got to eat shit and you got to earn it, I feel like. And it's more real that way for me. I mean, no disrespect to anyone who just kind of like makes it off the first shot, but that usually doesn't happen.
Right. Yeah. Or it's one of those things where it's like, whatever, using Davey Havoc as an example, again, like AFI is legitimately his first band. And it's just really funny to think about that. But it's like, well, if you look at what AFI sounded like at the beginning versus what they sound like now, it's like, you know, yeah, there's like 40 bands in there, like 40 different sounding bands. Totally. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's going to suck at first. And that's the thing that like, I always had trouble with that. Maybe I still do at some respect, like trying new things, because I love trying new things, but like, you're going to suck at first and you just got to get past it. It's like growing out your hair or something. You're going to have that awkward phase and you're going to hate it. You want to be like, I don't want to do this. I'm going to cut my hair. But like, eventually, you know, your hair grows or whatever.
Right. No, it's a very true point. So did you actually go to college at all, or did you basically, you know, after you graduated high school, you were just like, I got to, you know, work and figure something else out?
No, I got into a film school. It was the only school I got into because I had D's and F's throughout high school. I just never applied myself. I didn't want to. But I got into a super hippie type college that they didn't have grades, and you know, it's not surprising that this college does not even exist anymore. They're like $10 million in debt and shut down. So I have a useless degree from there. And that was in Burlington, Vermont. So I did that whole thing. And that's where I really kind of like stepped on the gas with the music stuff.
Got it. That's I love that idea of just, I mean, there are definitely liberal arts schools that have that sort of like, oh, you pick your own curriculum and you do that. But so was it kind of like that?
It was exactly like that. You know, kids not wearing shoes, kid, you know, like white people with dreads.
Sure. Right.
Just, yeah. Heady, super heady.
Right. And did you, I guess, did you feel like you had a college experience, like living in the dorms and kind of being away from home?
No, okay. There weren't any dorms. There were like apartments that I guess they owned, so they were like really like gnarly apartments that like you could live in, and it felt like a fever dream, honestly, if we're being honest. Like, it didn't feel like real life, but it eventually led me to Nothing Nowhere, because for my final art history project, the teacher was like, hey, just make a piece of art, like do whatever you want. And that ended up being Don't Mind Me, which was my first video and song is Nothing Nowhere.
Wow, that's pretty cool that you were able to. Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, you know, that's your thesis statement for or your dissertation or whatever.
Yeah, which is a trip to think about. I remember I went to bed and there was like 10,000 plays in the morning, which I never got even close to that. And I was like, oh, it's on. Like, I can't let this slip. And I just kept going.
Wow, that's really cool. And like you mentioned, kind of previous to that, there were, you know, a lot of different bands and projects that you were kind of playing a part of. Was it all basically just kind of in that whole, whatever, screamo, you know, punk and hardcore adjacent stuff that you were kind of sampling around with?
Yeah, it was just really, really, really bad. Pop punk, post-hardcore, you know, emo, whatever. It was just all that, but really bad. Right. That was like my childhood.
Right. Were you singing, playing guitar for this stuff, or was it a combination of all of them?
First couple bands I was ever in, I was the drummer. And then I started singing and playing guitars and like everything else. So a little bit of everything.
Okay. That's interesting. Drums. Was that just kind of like, oh, everyone else plays something, so Joe, get behind the kit?
No, I've started drums the same time as I started guitar. And
cool.
Yeah, I was like probably 12. And yeah, I love playing the drums. I mean, I don't get to play as much as I used to. I don't have a kit anymore, but I just started getting back into it. And yeah, I'm super about it for sure.
That's yeah, and that also adds another layer to your parents' patience, because clearly, man, drums are punishing.
Yeah. Oh man. Like, I used to come home from school and just rip the drums, and my sister would be asleep and come down in the basement and scream at me. And my mom, you know, so like the best parents ever. Like, they were just like, all right, like, you've been slamming the drums for like 3 hours, like, give it a break, you know, like,
right.
Like, the older I get, the more I'm like, wow, like that was awesome of them.
Sure. They're like, yeah, we've heard you playing, you know, really sloppy Sum 41 beats for 3 hours. Let's calm down, Joe.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Bless them.
No, that's really cool. And to your point, that again is something that, you know, your parents were just allowing you to follow the thing that they noticed that you were passionate about, which is really cool.
Yeah. Like, so lucky for sure.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. And I'm guessing with those bands, like, you were basically just kind of like playing regionally. Like, you probably had no, I guess, extensive touring experience with these bands, or was that not correct?
Ooh, yeah, no way. No.
Okay.
We would like rent out like a community center and like 10 people would show up, maybe, you know, or we would just, you know, I had some quote unquote bands where we would never even play a show. We'd just like play in the basement and like have a friend over or something and be like, check out this song. You know, I had never toured or anything.
Okay, got it. So that must have been a really wild experience for you to have the idea of what tour might be like with a band, and then, you know, your first touring experience being, you know, with Nothing Nowhere, where it's, you know, like ostensibly just you and maybe one other person on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a trip. I mean, thankfully I had a full band. You know, I kind of got on that train early. I was like, if I'm going to play shows, like, I might as well have a band. So
that's true.
I do remember, you know, buying a van and trailer and following Thrice's bus and, you know, pulling up to the first show at the Warfield in San Francisco and just looking up at the balcony and being like, how the hell did I get here? Like, this is insane. And just like, so nervous. I wanted to throw up. And it was like that for years, you know, before every show. So nervous I was about to throw up, or I did throw up. But yeah, it was just so much so fast, for sure.
Sure. Yeah. And that idea. Yeah. I mean, the idea of being able to exist in something that is similar to a band, i.e., you know, you enlisting, you know, your friends to help you play your music, that must have made it a lot easier than just being like, yeah, you know, you like a stand-up comedian with just a microphone and, you know, having backing tracks playing behind you.
Yeah. I don't, that would be so hard for me, you know, like having a band and, you know, knowing that we're all in it together is huge. Like, knowing like when you're backstage, like, and you're with your friends and, you know, my band is like, I'm like best friends, you know, and knowing that we're all experiencing it together makes it a lot easier for sure.
Yeah. And so as you started to, you know, navigate the world as nothing nowhere, where you started to feel, you know, like, yeah, I've got management now and like labels are looking at me and all that sort of stuff. You know, did you feel, I guess, kind of equipped for the attention, or was that something that you kind of had to, you know, navigate and learn as you went along?
No, I was not equipped for it. I was not expecting it, nor was I prepared for it. You know, flying out and meeting with all the major labels in LA and New York and, you know, doing all these insane meetings and talking to crazy people on the phone. It was so wild. And there's no manual for it. You know what I mean? There's no, who was I going to talk to? Like, hey, what did you do when you were flown out by major labels? And what did you do when Pete Wentz called you and said he wanted to like work with you? There's no blueprint. So I just kind of had to figure it out and go through it.
Right. Act like you belong.
I guess. Yeah. I still don't feel like I do. So.
Well, yeah, it's that weird sort of like pseudo confidence that you have to try to project to be like, yeah, no, I'm totally not freaking out when I'm talking to, you know, Pete Wentz from, you know, Fall Out Boy and Arma Angelou's. Like, this is, you know, I'm fine. I'm totally fine.
Yeah. It's all so weird. It's just bizarre. And there's always new stuff that comes up and, you know, you never know, like once a month, once every other month, you get an email of like some crazy opportunity and you're just like, all right, I guess, like,
right.
Right. And I just feel like, I don't know, like I even have like a sense of guilt about it or something. I know I shouldn't, because like, I know I worked hard, but there is that voice in my head that's like, dude, all you did was play guitar, you know?
Right. Well, and that idea that, you know, because you were doing something that was so relatively new to, you know, the music scene at large of, you know, being the, and I'm using this in air quotes because I always find this funny where it's just like, you know, the king of emo rap, not like anybody's called you that, but you know, I just find it
Everyone
funny.
Everyone called me that, Ray.
Yeah. That's true, Joe. Sorry. You are, I will give you the crown. You can take it. But just that idea of being like, oh yeah, I'm doing this. And ostensibly people are talking to me because they think that what I am doing is quote unquote ahead of the curve. And you know, I'm just trying to express myself. Like, why are all these weird things coming at me?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like now I've learned, you know, being in the music industry, like people freak out, like go insane when something new comes along and they're just like, oh, we got to throw money at it. We got to like, this is the hot new thing. And like, it's like Wall Street over there. It's crazy.
Right. That's a good way of looking at it, because it definitely is the notion of investing into stock and being like, oh, we're betting on the futures of this. And it's like, oh, exactly. Okay, I guess I'm right. Yeah, exactly. So when, you know, I realize this may be a loaded question, but when did you feel like it was getting, you know, I guess real for you, where it's like, was it when you were taking these meetings with major labels and stuff like that? Or was it, you know, the morning you woke up and you saw the 1,000 plays or whatever? It doesn't even have to be this like big dramatic, like clouds parting moment. But when did you feel like, oh, like people are gravitating towards this, and this is like the most successful thing I've done by a mile?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Cause I still struggle with that. I think it was okay. Just a slow process. Like, you know, it's, I remember being really shocked, like, you know, the first show of Thrice and playing that and, you know, pulling up to venues. And I remember feeling really weird meeting with all the labels. And, there's always been points in my career where I've just been like, what's even going on right now? And then, you know, even more recently, like a year ago, like buying a house, I was like, why? I never got a job. So this is cool. And yeah, I'm still struggling with that, I guess. Cause I'm just like, yeah, I guess it is real. You know, I always feel like it's just going to fall out from underneath me, which I know it isn't, but I'm just kind of like, that's what my mind does.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Right. No, sure. That I was actually going to ask that same exact thing where it's like, you know, I think most artists feel that sense of not, it can be dramatically defined as, you know, imposter syndrome where you like, I don't feel like I'm here, but just that idea that I could wake up tomorrow and like all the things that, you know, people care about will be passe. And all of a sudden I've got like, quote unquote, nothing to show from it from like a monetary perspective or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, like, thankfully, like, I guess there were some good things about my dad being an accountant, because early on when I started getting like, you know, checks, he was like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't, you know, buy motorcycles and cars or whatever, you know, like,
right.
Like, let's put that in a retirement fund and maybe you can have fun some other time.
Right.
So like, yeah, I think like that's another thing too, that like when labels throw like huge numbers at artists, like, it's scary, you know, because there's no way to be equipped to handle that. And like, just, they certainly don't teach that in school. So, you know, I don't know. It's gnarly.
Yeah. Well, it's good that, like you said, you had a figure like your father to just be like, hey, pump the brakes. Like, this is something that you should hold on to. And because who knows where this is going to be in a year, 2 years, 5 years, or whatever.
Yeah. He's like, your stock is too volatile.
Yeah, totally. He's like, we're, you know, I'm glad you bet on yourself, Joe, but, you know, like, let's be practical about this as well.
Yeah.
And so I guess as the business implications started to become more real, where you were making moves and signing labels, and like you said, you know, like actually getting paid to play shows and stuff like this, and selling merch and all this stuff, were you, you know, I know you always were working with, you know, Evange and management, and you had a team of people surrounding you, but, you know, did you feel comfortable with the business aspect, or like, how did your, I guess, evolution of the music business side of things start to, you know, play into the way that you think about your art?
I don't particularly like the music business. I think it's hard to mix like art with money. I mean, it always is, because, you know, there's going to be people within the music industry who look at songs through a different lens than an artist would. They're looking at songs, you know, does the chorus hit within 30 seconds? Is there an A and a B chorus? Can we push this to radio? Like, how much money is this going to make? And people won't say that outright, but like, you know, if they give you an advance, they want a return on their investment, or, you know, they, it's a business. And that, you know, has wrongfully influenced me in the past. And I've had to course correct multiple times, where I'm making a song and I'm loving it. And then I'm like, wait a second, like this chorus doesn't, you know, it doesn't hit early enough, or like the radio wouldn't pick this up. And I'm just like, what are you saying, dude? Like, just make music. Like, so I'd say that there's a lot of, there's been, I've had to like retrain my brain because it started to like rot with the whole music business thing.
And was that specifically because you started to see that, I guess, chasing the dragon's tail of like, oh, okay, I've been told that I need to pay attention to this, or like, this is kind of where my strength lies or whatever.
Yeah. You're just around it and you're in meetings and stuff and you hear people talking about it. And then you, before you know it, you start thinking of music as like how many streams, how much money, how much royalties. And I'm there's nothing wrong with wanting to make money off of your music. That's the goal. Like, that's not selling out or anything. Like, that's rad. Like, I don't have to have a job. But I think it's a slippery slope when you start like making every song, like having that mindset, it can be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. It starts to, you know, the whatever cart leads the horse as opposed to the, you know, horse like leading the cart, mm-hmm. where you're just following your artistic muse as opposed to, you know, following what the, you know, where the money lies or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that kind of, excuse me, like veganism and vegetarianism, you know, has crept into your life. And I know, like, you know, animal, for lack of a better term, like animal advocacy, you know, is this something that is important to you? When did that kind of, I guess, come into your focus or come into your picture? Was it, I'm going to presume, through music as well?
Yeah, not necessarily through music.
Okay.
This was in, so I've been vegan for 10 years. This was in 2011. I met the first vegan person, I guess, I've ever met. He was kind of a kid who went to school with me, and I just was like, what is this about? Like, what is veganism? And I remember like that night, or just struggling with it and thinking about it, because I'd never thought about like what I was eating or anything. And I watched a lecture by Gary Yourofsky on YouTube, where essentially it was just like talking about what you eat and the implications of what you eat, and talking about sentient beings and animals feeling pain. And I watched the entire thing. And at the end of it, I said, like, all right, like I can't bullshit myself anymore. Like, I can't lie to myself anymore. And I have zero arguments against this. That's what it came down to. It was like, okay, what I'm eating is impacting the planet. You know, animals deserve compassion and love. We have, you know, a limitless amount of things to choose from at the grocery store that don't inflict harm onto sentient beings. I think this is something that I want to do, because I want to put my head on the pillow at night knowing that I did not contribute to this. And it was kind of a wrap from there, and I never looked back.
That's an awesome story, just because having it so, you know, I guess like quickly open your eyes and so definitively push you in a direction where it's like, oh, so I've seen this thing now and I can't unsee it and my life will never be the same.
Totally. It was so visceral and so raw. And, you know, when you're at the grocery store and you see meat, which is like a body, like wrapped in cellophane, and there's such a massive disconnect, you know, you don't put the face to it, you know. Like, if they put the picture of like the animal, the exact animal that was slaughtered on the packaging, maybe that people would look at it differently. I don't know, but it's not something that societally that we ever think about. And I don't think anyone would want to slit the throat of whatever they're eating themselves. They just prefer not to think about it. And that's what I was, you know, I guess for like 19 years of my life, 18 years of my life. And, you know, I'm not one of those people who's going to like freak out on people for, you know, doing what they want to do. But if people are interested in veganism, like, hell yeah, like, let's talk about it.
Right. Yeah. You're like, yeah, I will, I'll be willing to, you know, point you in the right direction. So you show you some resources if you're curious about it, but you know, I'm not going to like yell you into submission.
Yeah. And I guess like musically too, like when I heard Gorilla Biscuits, like Cats and Dogs Have All the Luck, I was like, yup, this is awesome. Like, I don't want to just select which animals I choose to love. When I say I love animals, I say I love animals and I mean it.
Right. I am so glad you mentioned that song, because that is such a impactful, like it's also, all it does is pose a question. You're like, why do cats and dogs have all the luck? And you know, whatever age you listen to that, like there's no response that you can come back where it's like, yeah, why do cats and dogs have all the luck?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just, we picked a couple animals to domesticate and to become like our best friends. But you know, you spend some time with cows, pigs, or other livestock, you're like, oh my God, like this is the same connection that I have with a cat or a dog or something like that. It's really crazy.
Right, exactly. And it's like, just because a cow cannot sit in my lap does not mean it should be judged differently.
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. As you started to, you know, get out there and get more comfortable, you know, on stage, I mean, I know that you were always talking about the, you know, the nervousness that, you know, rightfully so, you know, plagues many people that go on stage and, you know, put themselves out there. But once you kind of took that like next level of jump where, you know, playing the Warfield is much different than, you know, when you went on tour with Fall Out Boy, was that like, were those two experiences, like, would you say similar in the sort of like understanding that, like, yes, I'm playing, you know, literal stadiums versus, you know, whatever, 2000 cap rooms? Or was that just like a completely different feeling entirely?
You know, what's funny is like, I almost feel like the first show that I played on the first tour, like real tour, the Thrice, that Warfield show, I feel like it was scarier than the, you know, playing in front of 15,000 people in an arena in Tampa for, before Fall Out Boy, because at some point it's just like, I don't even see people. Like I don't even, like there's so many people here that I can't even make out a face. So it was like almost like easier, where I was like, these people are like thousands of feet away from me. Like,
sure.
I can't even, like, I think my brain just short circuited. Like I was terrified before I got up there, for sure. Like we had the security guards like take us from the locker rooms up onto the back of the stage, and you just hear everyone in the arena and it sounds insane. I felt like Shaq or something. And then you get on, and then I got on stage and I was like, this is insane. And my brain couldn't really process it. So I think it's just like, you know, for me, when I play a show, it doesn't matter if it's like, you know, five people or 15,000 people. I think there's always going to be those nerves. And I think I've gotten better at it as the years have gone by, but low key kind of nervous for when touring comes back, cause I'm out of practice.
Sure. No, it's true. Just that feeling of like, okay, you know, yes, some of it is like riding a bicycle, but then there's always that component of, well, like, how different is this going to feel? Like, am I gonna know what, you know, I guess like to do up there?
Yeah, I'm always like freaking out about it. I always forget my lyrics too, so I like write them on my hand and stuff. And there's a picture of me and Pete right before the arena show, and he's like, "What's on your hand?" And I'm showing him my lyrics. He's like, I forget my lyrics. Like, that's my trademark, I guess.
Right. That is honestly, that's beautiful, just because it is. I mean, you are usually condensing so many more words than, you know, your average quote unquote rock band or whatever. So, you know, I totally understand where you're coming from, where it's like, yeah, I got to have a little cheat sheet. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. I'm a human.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You try to remember, you know, 1500 words in a 3-minute song. Like, that's not easy.
No, I can't even remember what I had for breakfast. I don't remember anything.
Right. Yeah. Don't expect too much from me, guys, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Two more things I wanted to hit on before I let you go was the, you know, the idea that, when you started to, you know, feel the, you know, anxiety bubble over and, you know, cancel tours and like everything that you did in order to protect your own mental, you know, health and safety. I think that, I mean, first of all, it was sick that you did that because, you know, I am glad that you are existing on this planet versus, you know, going an even darker route. But, you know, I think it really just puts into stark focus the fact that even though I'm sure people assume one thing about you being like, oh, dude, like Joe must be living the life, man. He's just like rapping across stages across the country and just like everything must be coming up aces for him. You know, so like, do you feel, I guess, I get proud in certain respects that you were able to, you know, shed that light and maybe make people feel less alone because you were just, you know, meeting them on their level.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I made that decision to cancel all the festivals and I guess effectively stop touring for like half a year, it was out of necessity. There's no way I would have been able to. I was at a point with my mental health where it was just, it had never been that bad. And I had an opportunity where I could have just been like, you know, due to unforeseen circumstances, I will not be doing this tour. But then I was like, you know what? Like, I'm going to be real and just tell it like it is. Like, I have nothing to be embarrassed about. Like, it's what I got, whatever. I don't care. And I was like, maybe like it would help other people if I'm just real about it. So I was like, hey, like, surprise, like I'm super depressed and anxious. I can't do this. And yeah, the response was overwhelming. And like everyone I ever knew reached out to me and was like, dude, like take all the time you need. And like, it was really like heartwarming to see that happen.
Yeah, that's amazing. I presume you probably also, you know, felt that response from, you know, the people who were fans of what you were doing and then also kind of the industry at large.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, there was like, there was like no one, I mean, maybe one or two, but there was literally like at large, no one who was bummed about it. Everyone was like, all right, like do you, like, that's fine.
Yeah. That's incredible. And then, yeah, for other bands and artists and people that were, you know, publicly sharing themselves, giving that notion of the space that they could need to create for themselves in order to make sure like, hey, you want, like you as the fan of me and then the art I put out there, like you want me to be here for another couple of years creating this stuff, right? Yeah. So like I need this.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like completely necessary. There's no way I would have been able to do it. So, I mean, it was just, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it was a lot, and I didn't have the coping skills to deal with any of it. So I had to just stop and then reassess.
Right. And did you, you know, if you mind me asking, like, was it diving into therapy? Was it just basically being able to, you know, set more roots for yourself? Because I know that, you know, you currently live in Vermont. Or was it basically just a mixture of all of it?
Oh, it was everything. I was like, whatever you got, like, send it my way. I was like, you got vitamins, you got, like, you know, actual, like, psychiatric drugs. I went to Buddhist temples and sat in contemplation with monks in Massachusetts. I did everything. Yeah. I mean, I got into riding my bike. I got into like polar plunges in at the beach. I just went on a journey and I was like, I don't want this to like end me. I want to beat this. And it's not like, like you ever really beat it. I mean, it's just taking it one day at a time, I guess. And I got out of that really bad rut that I was in for sure.
That's great. Yeah. You were casting the widest net possible to try to find a, you know, there, like you said, there's no solution, but there is right. Mechanisms in which you can deploy to make you feel, you know, more comfortable in your own skin at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great way to look at it. Kind of just trying everything you can to better yourself and knowing that it will get better and it will, you know what I mean? It's not every day is the worst day ever.
Right. Yeah. Only one of them can be like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Until the next one comes along and then you're like, oh, okay. So that's the bottom. All right, cool.
Beat it. Yeah.
Right. Have you, this is just out of pure curiosity, because I'm sure that, like you were mentioning before, you got thrown into these like really interesting circumstances, whether it's like, oh, you know, I got Travis Barker calling me up to do a collab or whatever. You know, what are some funny moments that you felt like, you know, your soul was leaving your body and you were kind of just like watching yourself experience this stuff, you know, whether it was like, you know, those phone calls that you were getting, or if it's something that it was like, wow, I'm doing this like really wild, you know, event that, you know, whatever. There's like so much random stuff that gets, you know, thrown at you. So when I kind of lay all that out, you know, are there things that pop to your mind?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like, I remember I was with Pete in LA and we were walking down the street and some kid hangs out. I'm walking with Pete Wentz and some kid hangs out the like the car window and he's like, "Nothing Nowhere," and he has like my shirt on, he's like, "Dude, I love you," and he just goes by, and I'm and he said nothing about Pete, and I was like, "Yo, you just got shown up, dude, like who's Fallout Boy?" And it's like moments like that are just so funny. And I remember being chilling at Travis's house and just having dinner with him and playing with his dogs and stuff and being like, this is weird, you know.
Right. I'm here.
You know, yeah, being overseas, playing sold out shows in London and having people scream your lyrics back to you. I'm just like, dude, what is even going on right now? Like, I knew when I was younger that I could do it, but I always did have that voice in my head that was like, yeah, but like, come on, you know? And then the fact that it happened is like, just, I'm super grateful and I got to like give it back to the universe somehow.
Yeah, no, I get that. I promise, last thing, but the notion of, you know, when you first started to put yourself out there and, you know, clearly how you were obscuring your face and, you know, there was that air of mystery where people were just like, oh, like, you know, I don't know who this person is. I don't even know his name and that sort of stuff. Do you felt like you, I guess, controlled that? I mean, clearly you controlled that narrative because that was a, you know, implicit decision you had made. Yeah. But, you know, in retrospect, do you feel like that was like you were glad you did that? You were kind of like, oh, maybe if I executed that a little bit differently, you know, how do you, I guess, reflect on that time?
I think it was a great way. It made it easier for me to kind of deal with it. And the fact that no one knew what I looked like for like, I don't know, like 2 years or something, unless they came to a show, it was like, you know, I'd have shows even, you know, before I played the show, I'd just be walking around in the venue and no one even knew it was me. And it was just made stuff like that way easier. And I guess like the main reason I wanted to do that was just kind of like build a foundation of music and be like, yo, if you mess with my music, that's cool. And then maybe like, you know, we could get to know each other as people later.
Right. It is true that you doing that honestly reminded me, like, there was you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of this band called Elliot. They were from Louisville, Kentucky. Oh. Put out some records on Revelation. Amazing, like, total, you know, mid to late 90s emo band. But, and clearly this was pre-internet, but like their whole vibe was, when they were setting up their equipment, they would, you know, they basically wore like kind of what, you know, you would wear like if you worked at a bank, just like, you know, slacks and like a, you know, like a white shirt and a tie or whatever. Yeah. And their whole thing was that they wanted a blank canvas for people, because, you know, if you see a band setting up their equipment and like dudes wearing a Madball shirt, you're like, okay, like, I know what I'm expecting. Yeah. And so they were kind of painting a blank canvas of that, because you wouldn't know what they would sound like. And so you were kind of doing that, you know, on that same idea where it's just like, I want people to interact with my music first and foremost, rather than any sort of image about who I am, besides the fact, like, you know, I got some sick hand tats or whatever.
Yeah. And like, I'm an idiot. So like, I'm just like dumb. And I make music like, and I was like, when I first had to like make an Instagram and all that, I was like, oh, why am I posting a picture of myself? Like, I'm just going to let you know when a song comes out, and like, maybe someday if you want to see what a dumbass I am, I'll show you.
Right. Yeah. You're just gonna have to wait for a little bit. Okay. Just,
yeah. Hold your breath.
Right, exactly. And that idea, too, that you were also, and I know this has been more of a recent thing, but just the idea that you were taking, you know, with like your merchandise and, you know, how you are modeling it after, you know, a lot of the influences that people see outside of, you know, punk and hardcore and independent music of just like, oh, hey, this is what, you know, like streetwear and fashion does, where it's like, I, you know, like you probably don't even have to like my band, but you look at this merch, you'll be like, oh, that looks sick. I'll probably buy that hoodie. Like, I don't like the music, but yeah. It looks good.
Yeah. That's the goal, is like I'm really into clothes and I wanted to make merch that was just anyone could wear, even if they didn't listen to it. Like, I encourage the poser like shirt move. That would be rad.
Right. And it is, I really do like that idea too of, you know, bands, like bands merch transcending the band, where it's just like, you know, in, I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about when I say the Bane hoodie, where it's like,
yeah,
you know that people bought that being like, oh, I've just like seen it at shows or whatever. Like, have you heard Bane? No, but I just like the design or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's, and I mean, that's like business wise too. Like maybe I don't have to like freak out about, you know, making that radio chorus as much if you have like a strong foundation in other areas of your business or your, you know, your band or whatever, you know.
Just good,
you know, it's a good thing to do.
It's very practical. It's like your dad taught you something, Joe.
Thanks, Dad.
Well, dude, thank you so much for hanging out. I really appreciate this and letting me ping pong around your brain, but this was great.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was rad. I appreciate it.
Pretty cool, right? Like I said, even if you do not identify with the art that he puts out, I think you will find some really interesting stories and common connections that you might not have thought you had with this person. So I know I did, and I loved him for coming on. So shout out to Joe, shout out to Mike, who is on his management team, who helped pull the strings together, and Yvonne, who also is his manager, and she's a great human being and a previous guest of this podcast. So big shout out to all those people for making this happen. Next week, I have Matt Cothran from the Bronx. I am so excited to have him on the show because he's a guy who we've traveled in the same circles and I've known him for a while, but to have just never reached out to be like, hey, Matt, how about you do the show? But then the opportunity came up to have him on the show because they have a new record coming out soon. And man, it was so much fun because Matt and I go pretty nerdy deep. I mean, as you would expect with this particular podcast, but that's what we got next week. Matt from Bronx. Boom. There you go. And until next week, please be safe, everybody.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.